From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we're engaging in some chillingly informed speculation. What would happen if we as a species lost access to our electronic records? What if, either by the slow creep of technological obsolescence or sudden cosmic disaster, we no longer could draw from the well of knowledge accrued through the ages? What if we fell into a digital dark age? We do know that the march of progress, the steady extinction of audio cassettes and videotapes, floppy disks and operating systems, has already extinguished parts of your personal history, because you told us.
This is David Gable in New York City, and the loss that comes to mind is wondering why I ever got rid of that little tiny cassette that used to be inside 1980s phone answering machines, because I kept it for a long time after my boyfriend died of AIDS in 1988, and I kept the last message I had from him. And it was not a particularly interesting message, it just was his voice. And I kept thinking, what's this cassette ever going to fit? And the day came when the machine just broke, and I tossed it and got rid of that little tiny cassette. And I wish I hadn't. Because it would be nice to hear his voice at this point.
In our eagerness to embrace the limitless storage capacity of new technology, we are losing the documents of our past. This week, a guide to the once and future digital dark age. The first scenario is not speculation. It happened.
As far back as 1990, the New York Times described NASA's massive archive from early space flights as edging closer to the brink of technological extinction. The agency hadn't thoroughly cataloged 1.2 million magnetic tape reels of images and data from 260 scientific missions. Hundreds of thousands of tapes were kept under, quote, deplorable conditions. In fact, NASA says the original tapes of the Apollo moonwalk probably were erased and reused in the early 1980s. That grainy image you've seen of the giant leap for mankind is really a copy of a copy. So are most photos from space.
I remember the first image from Lunar Orbiter 1 that showed the Earth rising above the lunar surface. Now, technically it was setting, but it became called Earthrise.
Keith Cowing is co-founder of the Lunar Orbiter Image Recovery Project, or LORP, which endeavors to rescue 1960s NASA data, such as that iconic image, Earthrise. You've seen that black and white photo snapped in 1966. In the foreground, the vast craters of the moon, and floating above, where the lunar horizon fades into black, a bright crescent of the Earth with white swirls of atmosphere. When Keith Cowing first saw it, he was a young teenager.
As a matter of fact, I was getting in the car to go see the film 2001 for the very first time in theaters, and I had a National Geographic book with me, and the frontispiece was that photo. So for me and many people my age, this was really seared in my memory. And the way that we saw it, or at least I saw it, it had these lines through it, and it was pretty primitive, but this is the first time anybody had really seen Earth in a context as part of the Earth-Moon system.
The photo looked primitive because at the time, NASA's ability to collect data outstripped its ability to clearly display it or even see it. Images of the moon's surface taken by the five Lunar Orbiter spacecraft were so large, they were beamed back to Earth in sections as data, then recorded to magnetic tape reels and printed out on photographic paper, and then photographed again.
They had these giant pieces of newsprint in an old church or a factory, and they just put them together and they hung them there. Then they say, all right, now we can kind of understand how this looks and photograph it again. So, you know, right off the bat, you're losing some resolution. And because of the way that photographic film worked and so forth, you get these variations towards the edges, the sort of zebra striping.
Once the Lunar Orbiter had fulfilled its mission to find a suitable spot for the Apollo 11 landing in 1969, nearly all of the thousands of 2-inch magnetic tape reels it recorded were either discarded or reused. That is, except for just one set, stored away in protective canisters sealed with whale oil.
We don't really use whale oil anymore, but that's sort of the secret sauce, apparently, to what helped keep these alive. Somebody just thought ahead did precisely what you'd need to do to keep these tapes in pristine condition.
One full set of the original tape reels, with their whale oil, were passed around for nearly five decades, narrowly escaping destruction. In 2006, they resurfaced again, and LORP was born. But what good are tapes if you don't have a refrigerator-sized Ampex FR-900 tape drive to play them on? Nearly all of those machines had been lost as well. But a former NASA employee, Nancy Evans, had miraculously used her own money to buy four of them for safekeeping.
She stored them in a barn in her backyard in Central California, which is nice and dry. And when we contacted her, her daughter now ran the place, and she was a holistic veterinarian. And when we went there to pick them out, there were the drives, nice and just sitting there covered with dust and farm animals walking around.
The early history of space exploration stowed in a barn.
So we just fortuitously had two independent paths that caused the tapes and the drives to still exist decades later. Now we just had to make them work.
It was just the beginning of digital resurrection as Andy Hardy movie. Hey kids, let's salvage our scientific legacy. The team happened upon an air conditioning repairman whose brother had worked with Ampex drives and could help rebuild them. The gang shopped for spare parts on eBay and at Radio Shack. NASA offered them an empty McDonald's in Silicon Valley to work in, and they renamed it McMoons. And they found documentation of a mathematical formula needed to demodulate the images.
We just expected that we had some sort of guardian angel of techno-archaeology that would just solve our problem in the most absurd way possible. And we cobbled it all together. And then in a scene that was just like out of the movie Contact, where they're playing with a transmission that was being sent back by aliens, and they said, turn it this way, turn it that way. Suddenly, there was the picture.
Can you clean it up any more than that fish?
I'm working on it.
We saw, in this case, the white of space, which is the black of space, because these images were negative, and then the darkness of the moon. And when you flipped it, there it was. There was the image we were looking for, just like that.
The team published its first recovered image in 2008, a streak-free version of Earthrise, seen in higher resolution than ever before. LORP has since rescued thousands of other images, but this was more than an exercise in nostalgia. The project has rescued clear images of the Antarctic, captured by satellite in the 60s, and NASA has found reels containing ozone levels from the 1970s, both troves of baseline data for understanding the effect and rates of ice melt and climate change.
So we're half a century late, but, you know, later is better than never.
Keith, please tell me that today in 2015, NASA and other government agencies that are marshaling gigantic scientific projects are not going to leave it for future techno-archaeologists to jerry-rig solutions, that there is a plan in place to preserve what we are spending billions to discover?
Well, no and yes. We've got spacecraft that generate terabytes of data like on a daily basis, and it's being stored on hard drives, and hard drives fail. And if you store it on DVDs, well, over time, the plastic degrades. And so archiving all this stuff, what do you archive it on? So I fear that, you know, we're going to be losing stuff. And unless the programs specifically say you're going to save your material in a certain way, it may be lost.
Keith Cowing is a former NASA employee and is now editor of the blog NASA Watch. He was co-founder of the Lunar Orbit Image Recovery Project, but has since left the team.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.